Nate, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
I want to ask you, when did you first become interested in drumming?
You know, I was about 4 years old, and my parents would take me to Tennessee State. They were at Tennessee State University at the time. They were just finishing. They had just graduated, so we would go to Tennessee State University football games. And me, at 4 years old, I was, fascinated by the halftime show, by seeing the band. So at that age, I basically started coming home from those games and trying to pretend to be the marching band. And so that sort of grew into me building drum sets out of buckets and cardboard boxes and whatever I could find around the house. And that's how it all started, when I was 4 years old, basically.
What is your earliest musical memory?
That, probably. That's probably my earliest musical memory. I remember that I remember this very clearly, I don't know why. I would get salad spoons out of my out of the kitchen, and I would get a belt, and I would use the belt to attach a box or a bucket around my waist.
Wow.
Like the guys in the marching band, like the drummers in the marching band, and I would march around my house playing all day. And then somehow from there, I'm not sure, I guess my first exposure and my first memory of sort of drum set was seeing Animal play on the Muppets, you know, and then that kind of, the combination of Animal playing on the Muppets and marching band is what got me into playing drums, you know, at age 4.
So did you drive your parents nuts with all this drumming?
You know, that's an interesting question, and looking back on it, I imagine that to some extent I must have, but at the time we lived in a house, and so my mom, that is, you know, was basically happy that I was just, you know, in the garage banging on drums all day, and really was quite pleased, you know, wasn't concerned about that at all. It's a lot more constructive than a lot of things I could have been doing, you know what I mean?
Who were some of your early musical influences?
Well, the first would be Animal from the Muppets. You know, I say that, you know, partially tongue in cheek, partially not, because at age 4, as I said, you know, that was pretty amazing to watch, you know, the Muppets. It's actually funny, a friend just gave me the DVD set of like the first season of the Muppets. And so, you know, now at age 30, I sit back and I watch the Muppets and I kind of went, you know, wow, I can't believe on TV then, and this is what I was watching, and it's no wonder that I was so into it. I mean, that show is so incredible for the music. So Animal from the Muppets would be my earliest memory, my first influence, and all of that. But then as I grew up and I started to listen to more and more and more music, I was exposed to everything in my house. You know, from the age of 4 to 7, you know, I basically had my father in the house every single day playing Stevie Wonder, Jimi Hendrix, Grand Funk Railroad, Earth, Wind, and Fire, the Commodores, LTD, you know, the Barclays, and it just went on and on. Van Morrison, you know, so these are the things that I listened to as a you know, whatever, first grader, kindergarten, first grade, second grade. And then on from that was, you know, Michael Jackson and George Clinton and all that. So that was, you know, those are my earliest musical influences. And it's interesting that they were very, 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 very diverse then. Everything from, you know, my father would listen to a lot of Chick Corea at the time, which I happen to be listening to right now.
Cool.
He would listen to everything from that to Jimi Hendrix, you know. And so I had all of that in my house growing up. So even though he didn't play, I was exposed to all of it, and I really owe him a great debt of gratitude for exposing me to all that music at such an early age. I don't believe he did it necessarily intentionally. I don't think he said, "I want my son to grow up and be a professional musician, so I'm always going to play music." It was just the way that he was, you know.
I want to get back to Animal for a second. Are you aware? Now I saw this. Are you aware that Animal had a drum battle with Buddy Rich?
I am, and I've seen it many, many, many times. And I understand that Buddy, you know, edged him out.
You think so?
Yeah. Well, I remember at the end, Animal basically sweating and being out of breath, and Buddy, Rich just blowing and blowing and blowing, you know.
I want to ask you about someone who's, I think, was very important in your life early on, and that's Grant Menifee. How important was he to your...
You know, Grant was the first bona fide drum set instructor that I ever had. Up to studying with Grant, you know, in the fourth grade, I had a band director who showed me how to hold drumsticks, basically, and showed me a couple of rudiments. But until studying with Grant, I had not, you know, studied drum set formally. And he definitely took a bunch of sort of just scattered ideas that I had and was able to sort of bring them all together and make sense of it all, you know, and fill in a lot of gaps for me and expand what I could do playing-wise and push me beyond where I, you know, ever thought I would necessarily be playing drums. And moreover, you know, Grant was the first sort of, how can I put this? My parents were always, you know, very encouraging as well. But Grant was one of the first people who actually said, you know, you could actually make a living at this, you know, which is a big deal to hear as a kid, because I personally felt like in my growing up, there were not enough positive influences. There were more people saying, well, you know, it's fine that you play music, but you need to make a living. You know what I mean? There were many more people saying that than there were saying, you know, if you really put your mind and your heart to it, you could make a living playing music. And so Grant was one of the very first people who said that. And another was Cynthia Shepherd, who was a middle school music teacher that I had.
Grant seems to be the catalyst for you that sort of set you into a focus that this is what you really wanted to do.
Yeah, I would credit him with that. I would definitely credit him with that. I owe him in many respects for going to Berkeley. I mean, he himself is a Berkeley graduate. He told me a lot about the school. He taught me in a way that prepared me well for the school. So then when I later, you know, transferred from University of Maryland to Berklee College of Music, I was, you know, kind of well prepared for what I was about to face.
If there was one artist or even group that you would like to land a gig with, who would that be?
That's an interesting question. And it has changed, you know, over the course of time. You know, it changes kind of constantly what I'm really, really into. But I would say that probably the all-time, you know, great fun gig that I would love to do or to have an opportunity to do would be to play with Sting. I think that Sting is one of the, you know, great songwriters of our time, and I you know, everything from The Police to what he's doing now and sort of constantly evolving and sort of being able to be commercially successful, extremely commercially and mainstream successful, while at the same time, you know, his music consistently has, you know, a very high degree of sort of musicality and
wide appeal.
I don't want to say complexity, but I mean, it's sort of, you know, what I kind of call smarter than the average pop, you know? And so that's one of the things that I've always, always, always loved. And like I said, that goes all the way back to The Police.
You must have had fun on Rockstar when Delana was singing Every Breath You Take.
You know, Delana, I have fun playing anything that we do together. She's really, really, really talented. And then, moreover, I have a lot of fun playing on the show, period, because, you know, there's a tremendous challenge in the fact that every week our set list changes, and every week I'm learning anywhere between, you know, 8 and 15 or 20 new songs basically every week to prepare to play. So there's a tremendous challenge in that. But there is also an eternal freshness that comes from that. You know, eternal freshness, that sounds like it should be a laundry detergent. But there's a constant sort of, you know, newness. You know, every week you walk in and it's a totally new set list. And it's almost like, you know, if you had the opportunity to tour with all those different artists, like, that we're playing the songs of each week, you know what I'm saying? For example, the week that we got to do In the Air Tonight, that was, you know, until Phil Collins called me, that's the closest that I'm going to get to really getting to play that song. And it was amazing to be able to play it on television and, you know, and for the show. And I sort of felt like I had to honor the drummers of the world by trying to accurately sort of, you know what I mean, put across that song.
What a way to spend the summer.
Oh, yeah.
Man.
Oh, yeah. It's a great, great, great time.
Wow. What brand of drums do you play?
I am a Pearl endorser. I have been for about a decade. I love them, and they're great to me. Just the product that I play, because they've been really very, very kind and gracious to me over the years, and so I should really give a shout out to them. So I play Pearl drums, Zildjian cymbals and sticks, and Remo drum heads, and Rhythm Tech percussion equipment.
I was
going to say, I also have a connection with Roland that I value greatly.
I was just going to ask you, what is it about Pearl that you like so much?
You know, when I was looking to, first of all, I've played Pearl since I was in college. And at the point that I had done a couple of gigs and I had a couple of, you know, things on my resume, and I sort of felt like maybe it's time to look into pursuing an endorsement, I spent a lot of time sort of investigating the different companies and kind of what they do, what, you know, the lines of drums that are available and the hardware in particular. And what I found was that for me, Pearl was the best combination of drums and hardware, in the sense that they made this. They make a drum rack. Well, then you know that Pearl makes the Icon drum rack, which has square tubing as opposed to the round tubing. And so that was kind of a big deal for me because I felt like I didn't want anything to ever slip. And on the round tubing, sometimes it's easier for things to sort of slip and move around. And so that was kind of what decided it for me.
Do you use different kits or setups depending on the gig?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The kit that I play on the show is a kit that I assembled specifically for that show, kind of with the mindset, you know, of I'll be playing, you know, a lot of big rock songs. So hence I have 24-inch kick drum. You know, my first rack is a 13, and then my two floors are 16 and 18. Whereas, you know, I would not bring the same gear if I were playing a singer-songwriter gig, you know, at a club here in L.A. I would probably bring a 20-inch kick and, you know, maybe no toms. Or if I bring a tom, maybe only a 14-inch floor tom, you know. So, yeah, absolutely. Definitely changes from gig to gig.
I have to tell you something. Yesterday I was watching your video
on
your drum set with my 9-year-old nephew, and his jaw dropped for the whole he said, "My God, that's complicated." But it works.
And is your nephew a drummer?
No, not yet.
Well, let's get him started.
No. Yeah.
Let's get some sticks in his hands.
I think I will, yeah. You mentioned that your dad loves jazz.
Yes.
And you also mentioned earlier that he had a profound influence on you. What exactly was that influence, and what was the most important lesson that you learned from your dad when it comes to music?
The influence that my dad had on me growing up was basically, you know, he being the huge music fan that he was. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, there was always music playing in my house. And I have, you know, fond memories of looking back on sort of Saturday mornings and Sunday mornings being awakened to the sound of it. Those particular periods of time, Saturday and Sunday mornings, my dad played what I refer to this day as Sunday morning cooking breakfast music, because basically my dad would get up and cook breakfast, and he would put on Spyro Gyra or Chick Corea or, you know, Weather Report. And so those bands to me always kind of inspire that memory, Sunday morning cooking breakfast music. I would wake up Sunday mornings, my dad would be cooking breakfast, and that's what would be on the radio, on the stereo playing. So beyond that, he was the first person to take me to concerts, you know, and encourage me to go and hear live music. He would take me to see Spyro Gyra when they were in town, or Weather Report, or, different bands like that. When I was 10, somewhere, 10, 12, somewhere in there, you know. I mean, I don't know if you remember the concert film Stop Making Sense by the Talking Heads.
Yes.
But, like, my dad took me to see that when it was in the theater. You know what I mean? So that was kind of a real, at the time I didn't realize how much of an influence it was, but that was a real positive and very strong influence on me. And in terms of lessons that I've learned from my dad, I actually, in terms of lessons that I've learned about music, let me address lessons that I've learned about life from my dad, because this is actually something very important that I learned, and I can point to a specific event that happened that I recounted a couple of times, but I will now recount it for, you know, for your listening pleasure.
Sure.
I was in a McDonald's with my dad once, and they had all these balloons for all the kids because Ronald McDonald was coming that day, and I think I was about, I was probably 13 or 14 or something like that. And as we got, you know, to the front of the line, my dad said, "I want a balloon." And I'm like, why do you want a balloon? What are you talking about? So we got to the front of the line, and we ordered our food, and my dad said, "Oh, and can I have a balloon?" And, you know, the clerk kind of looked at him, kind of raised an eyebrow, and, you know, gave him a balloon. And I was, you know, mortified, of course, because I was a teenager, and as a teenager, you know, anything mortifies you. Your parents do anything to embarrass you, you know, die. So I, you know, yell at my dad. I'm like, "What do you want a balloon for? Why do you want a balloon? You know, they're for the kids." And my dad kind of goes, "Well, why?" And I was like, "Well, why what? You know, well, why are they for the kids?" You know, my dad basically said, "At what age are you too old to enjoy getting a balloon? You know, what's the cutoff? Who determines when you have to be an adult now and you have to no longer enjoy, you know, anything that you enjoyed as a kid, you know?" And that was very inspiring to me. I kind of went, wow, you know, you're right. And it's partly that sort of led to the fact that I am a professional musician to this day, because at that point playing music, you know, at a certain point, a lot of musicians coming up, they hit a point where they go, "Okay, well, you know, this music thing is really fun, but now I guess I need to be an adult and go and get a job and go and grow up." And in part due to that conversation that I had with my father that day in McDonald's, I never grew up. I pretty much never abandoned being a kid, having a love for playing music, and just wanting to play music all the time. I just sort of, you know, staved off the idea of ever having to sort of conform to societal, you know, "Now it's time for you to get a job." And so for better or for worse, that resulted in, you know, where I am today and why I'm a musician.
You know what, Nate? You're to tell you the truth, you're really freaking me out. I'm going to tell you why, okay? Because for me, that is the most important lesson that I think you have ever learned in your life. Because I have been telling people for years exactly what you said. And, you know, I just turned, I'm turning 50 on Thursday. And let me tell
you, happy birthday,
Vivian. Thank you very much. I refuse to grow up. And that's what keeps things fresh. And that's going to be a nice segue into my next question. Because this next person I want to ask you about hung around and made a point of hanging around with young people. And that's why he made great music. I want to know what influence Miles Davis had on you as a musician.
Oh, wow. Oh, man. You know, Miles, I don't know if you know this or not, but I have a son named Miles. Do you know that?
No.
Yeah, I have a son named Miles. And, I mean, so that can give you some insight into the influence that Miles Davis had on me. You know, obviously, the body of work musically that's out there that Miles, you know, left for all the world is amazing. I mean, it's one of the most amazing catalogs in all of music ever. And it's incredible to me that with every, you know, Miles Davis record, or maybe every two records, he just completely changed the way that people conceived music. You know, it was like, well, I realize that everyone is doing this particular thing now, but I'm going to go ahead and record Sketches of Spain, you know, or I'm going to go ahead and record Kind of Blue, you know, and I'm going to turn music upside down. And everyone is going to conform to what I just did because it's so far ahead of the curve that, you know, they have to now catch up to me. And so that's kind of what I admired, is the fact that he was always a trendsetter as opposed to a trend follower. You know, I mean, there's a couple of great, I love this particular Miles story, but evidently, and I'm recounting it, you know, I've read it somewhere and I hope that I sort of do the story justice. But evidently, when Miles recorded, what was it? I think it was Sketches of Spain. He kind of went in and said, you know, here's this record. And think at the time, correct me if I'm wrong, was he on Columbia at that time?
Yes.
Sketch of Fame is Columbia, right?
Yeah.
So he went to, you know, Columbia and gave them Sketch of Fame, and they kind of said, well, Miles, you know, we're a little bit concerned about this record because we think that your fans might be expecting to hear, you know, kind of blue. And Miles said, tell them to listen to that record. You know what I mean? It's like, if they want to hear Kind of Blue, tell them to listen to Kind of Blue. This is what I'm doing now, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I've always sort of admired that, you know? And basically, when I think of Miles Davis, I think of not only a great musician, but basically a great man who sort of always followed his own path, you know, and earlier in his career was fired from any number of bands because they said, you know, why are you playing that nonsense? We want you to play, you know, this more traditional style, and lost gigs and everything else, and essentially lost gigs because he said, I know that what I'm doing has merit, and I'm going to continue to do it, and at some point you may or you may not realize that what I'm doing has merit, but I'm going to do it whether or not, you know, you think it does or not. And so it's very funny because I named my son after him, and my son is growing up sort of in the mold of his name. I mean, he's definitely growing up very much like, you know, I'm going my own path, and it's the path that I'm going on, and you know, if you feel as though it's not the right path for you, that's fine. But here's the path that I'm on. Yeah, so it's very exciting. I'm sure in many ways naming your son Miles and being as into Miles as I am, it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. But it's funny. He is definitely a Miles, and I think that he will definitely carry on sort of the tradition of that name and everything that it means.
Good. What was the most inspiring concert that you ever attended?
The first one that comes to mind is my father taking me to, where did we live at the time? I'm trying to remember what venue it was exactly. But my father taking me to hear Spyro Gyra was actually very inspiring. And it was inspiring because up to that point, you know, I had never seen a drummer take a drum solo. And at the time, during that era, the drummer was Richie Morales. And he took the drum solo, and it was amazing to me. And it inspired me to practice hours and hours a day for weeks on end because I wanted to be able to do, you know, that. I wanted to have some amount of facility. But there are, you know, there are definitely a few concerts that stick out of my mind. I got a chance to hear Art Blakey, you know, shortly before his passing back in Baltimore. When I lived in Baltimore, I went to Artscape. And Artscape, for people who may not know, is like a big jazz festival that happens every year in Baltimore. And so I went and had an opportunity to hear Art Blakey there. Who else did I hear there that year? A lot of great, great, you know, talented folks. So
I have to tell you, when I was a young teenager, it was around 12 or 13 years old, my father was not musical at all. But he took me to a concert that was pivotal in my life, and it was two amateur musicians by the name of Dizzy Gillespie and, Gene Krupa.
Really? Those guys?
Yeah, playing with their own bands. But when I think the thing that really knocked me out was when Dizzy Gillespie came out on stage and he said, I have a good friend of mine that's playing at a club downtown Montreal, the Esquire Show Bar. I'd like to bring him out to play a couple of tunes with me, and out walks Rossan Roland Kirk. I didn't know who this man was. All I saw was this guy with sunglasses and about three or four saxes hanging out of his mouth. And,
right.
You know, I could fully understand what you were talking about before with your dad and, you know, concerts when you're young and just getting exposed to this great music.
And you don't know. You don't know when you're a kid. I mean, I think that as a kid, it's impossible to sit back and go, wow, I don't believe I'm being exposed to this. I'm going to really appreciate this 30 years from now. You know what I mean? You can't know that as a child. But it's funny when you grow up and you look back on it and you go, wow, I can't believe I had the opportunity to do that.
And keep in mind that this is before the internet.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So we only
That's
had magazines
true.
And, you know, radio and stuff like that.
That's
but,
true.
Here's something I hope you remember, but I want to ask you, Do you remember your first gig as a professional?
Ooh, that's interesting. Well, you know, as a professional musician, it's like, I remember, it was kind of like a ramp up. I mean, I definitely remember graduating Berklee College of Music and, you know, graduating and going out to a big dinner with my parents and celebrating and having a great time and realizing, wow, I've done it. I graduated Berklee College of Music. And then waking up the next morning and going, okay, what do I do now? I definitely remember that. You know, one of my earliest gigs, I used to play, when I lived on the East Coast, I played jazz gigs in New York City with a saxophonist named Chico Freeman. Are you familiar with Chico Freeman?
Very, very. I've seen him on several occasions.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and his father, Vaughn Freeman. Yeah, oh, yeah.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. Well, Chico was one of the first gigs that I ever did. And he was, you know, it was definitely, I learned a lot, man. I learned a lot, you know. Mm. I had done gigs prior to locally in Boston, but one of the first sort of real quote unquote gigs was with Chico, and we went to Europe a couple of times and toured doing his at the time he had a jazz fusion project called Brainstorm, and yeah.
What was it like playing with him?
What's that?
What was it like playing with him?
It was a very fast education. It was a very fast education because I was, you know, a punk kid coming out of music college who, you know, thought I knew a thing about playing. And part of going to a music college is learning, you know, as much as you could possibly learn. And then part of getting out of music college is learning when not to do that stuff. Mm. You know, and think that it's not always that hip as a drummer to say, turn the string around every single time you think you can, or to superimpose 4/3 every single time you think you can. And so I learned that basically through Chico, you know. And you understand what I'm saying. I mean, him guiding me and sort of saying, you know, no, that's not where you do that. Here's how you do that, and here's what you do. So
It's interesting that you're saying this because years ago we had two main schools where musicians could go and learn, and one of them was the Art Blakey School and the Miles Davis School, who had excellent bands and students could just go play with them, and, you know, we don't seem to have that anymore.
Yeah, well, you know, I will say that Art Blakey was, you know, the Jazz Messengers was like, it was a school. You're right. You're absolutely right. That's the best way to possibly put it. And yeah, maybe there's not so much anyone carrying on that tradition right now, huh?
Oh, someone's got to do something about that. what are some of your favorite jazz recordings, Nate?
Well, first and foremost, I mean, if you only own one jazz record, you have to own Kind of Blue.
Definitely.
You know, yeah, if you only own one jazz record in your entire collection, you got to own Kind of Blue. I love the live train recordings, like the live in Paris or whatever, when he's got like that band. It's freaking Elvin Jones and Jimmy Garrison, and it's just insane. And why am I blanking? Is it Red Garland on that?
Is it Red Garland or was McCoy still with him then? I can't.
Could be McCoy. I'm totally blanking right now. But like those Impulse, you know, Live at the Village Vanguard,
yes.
Those. They're amazing. They're ridiculous. Let's see, other favorite jazz recordings. I have to be honest because I grew up with, you know, a certain amount of jazz fusion. So, you know, Cobham, Power Play was one of the first, you know, fusion records that I ever checked out. Chick Corea, you know, which is interesting. Chick Corea, the first Chick Corea records that I ever heard were like, you know, the Electric Band and what's the one, Light Years and those records. And then I sort of started going backwards into Now He Sings, Now He Sobs and like the more straight ahead. And then that's actually kind of what got me into listening to more straight ahead music, is going backwards from Chick Corea. But those are some of the earlier recordings I listened to. Chick Corea, the Friends, Chick Corea Friend with Gad on it, killing.
Joe Farrell was on that too, I think, wasn't he? Or
really?
I think Joe Farrell was on that. Yeah, Steve Gadd. Yeah, that was it was certainly a moment for him.
I you know, it's like hearing Gadd solo on a Samba Song on that record. You know, it's like I went, wow, you can make the drums sound like that? Holy cow. So, yeah, that was, you know, those were great recordings for me at the time. And you can imagine how odd I was, because basically in middle school and high school, that was what I was listening to, you know, primarily. Middle school particularly. High school, I started listening to more rock music, and I started playing in rock bands and so on. But, you know, I was walking around when everyone else was listening to, I don't know, whatever was on the radio at that time. I don't even know what it was, to be honest. And I was listening to, you know, Chick Corea and Spyro Gyra.
Yeah, wow. What would you like me to play?
Oh, do I get to choose something?
Sure.
Interesting. Let me think.
I'm going to use it on my show.
Okay. What would I like you to play? Well, we've talked so much about him and what influence he is. How about Milestones?
Sure.
Beautiful. Love that track.
Max Roach, Buddy Rich, and many other drummers took part in drum battles over their careers. I was just wondering if there's any jazz drummers out there that you would love to have a drum battle with.
Oh, my God. You know, I wouldn't want to have a drum battle, per se, with anyone. but if I could sort of play, if I could play with any drummer, do they have to be living?
No. It would make it more interesting.
Elvin. It would definitely be Elvin.
Mm.
He is, as far as I'm concerned, you know, the all-time sort of most, you know, one of the most powerful drummers ever. You know, I mean, he played jazz with the fire that John Bonham played with, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay, if I had to say living... I have to say, because I think he is so musical, I think he is one of the most musical contemporary jazz drummers, is Winard Harper.
Oh, yes.
Wow. I think Winard Harper is incredible. And I'm inspired by drummers who have loads of facility, but use it in the most musical of ways.
Mm.
You know, and so Winard Harper is amazing for that to me.
You spent some time at Berklee. What was that like for you?
It was amazing. Going to Berklee was probably the single best thing that I ever did to advance my musical career. You know, it was a great opportunity. It was eye opening in many ways, and thanks in great part to Grant Menifee, I was sort of, you know, ready to experience that. And it was competitive and at the same time encouraging, and it sort of, in many ways, represented a microcosm of, or was a microcosm of the actual industry, in the sense that at Berklee, you've got students who are majoring in songwriting, you've got students who are majoring in recording and engineering, you've got students who are majoring in, you know, performance, obviously, and if a teacher assigns a songwriting major an assignment, your assignment is write a 4.5 minute, you know, pop song and get it recorded. Okay, so now that person has to write the song. Then they've got to get in touch with a producer/engineer to get studio time to get that recorded. Once they do that, that person's got to get in touch with musicians to come and record that project. And you learn a lot about, you know, interpersonal relationships in that musical environment and how to get along with people in the studio and having your drums sound good and being prepared, writing charts, doing a good job on the first take or whatever, or staying focused in sessions. All the things that you learn there can be, you know, directly applied to everything that you will deal with on a day-to-day basis as a professional musician. And there are many lessons that I learned there that continue to help me out every single day.
So you're learning how to collaborate with people that you'll be working with in the industry.
Absolutely, among other things. I mean, that's one particular lesson that I learned. But yeah, it's also the cool thing about Berklee. They should be paying me for this. The cool thing about Berklee is that you get the opportunity to learn by making a lot of mistakes, before your career is hinging on it.
Mm.
Understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
So you get the opportunity, for example, to walk into a session with, say, a floor tom that rattles and have the engineer go, Nate, why is your floor tom rattling? And you go, and then you kind of get a chance to figure it out in what is a relatively safe environment. If you were to, say, walk into Capitol Recording Studios and your floor tom was rattling inexplicably and you couldn't figure out why and you didn't know that it was, you know, before you have the chance to say, hey, yeah, well, let me take it apart and figure out what this is, you are replaced. Omar Hakim will be rolling in, you know, he'll be rolling in Omar Hakim's gear and rolling yours out. So Berkeley, in many respects, was really cool for that, because you get to learn a lot. You know, you get to learn a lot without it jeopardizing or damaging your career, hopefully.
What was the most important lesson that you learned while you were there?
I learned a lot about having a strong work ethic and understanding that it's important to treat every gig as though it is the last gig that you will ever play. Mm. You know, it is important to always... whether there are, I mean, this is an often repeated sort of, you know, postulate, but whether there are 3 people in the room or 300 people in the room or 3,000 people or 300,000 people, you should treat it with equal sort of importance, and you should give it the same amount of weight, and you should, you know, attack it as though you would, you know, any other gig. You should always, you know, give it your utmost. And so I learned a lot about that at Berkeley, because... you know, I mean, you could be playing a gig and there could be 4 people in the room, but one of those 4 people could be the person who calls you to do a gig outside of the college. And at that time, you know, that was a big deal. Being able to gig, you know, doing cap shows and recitals, cap shows were shows that they did in the cafeteria there at Berkeley, but doing cap shows and recitals and, you know, senior concerts was great. But being able to actually break into the quote-unquote scene and do gigs where you actually made a little bit of money was like kind of a big delineating sort of line. So, you know, one gig leading to the next is contingent upon you always playing the best that you possibly can play.
How did you land the gig for both Rockstar series?
Rockstar was, that came about through an audition that was held here in Los Angeles. And as the concept of the show came together, the Mark Burnett Productions had auditions where they called different potential musical directors and basically said, we would like you to assemble a band to come and audition for this particular show that we're doing. So they called perhaps 18 or so, maybe 20 musical directors and said, put together a band to come and audition. And then upon those however many bands there were auditioning, they sort of reviewed and chose the players that they wanted from each individual band. So even though people auditioned as a band, they did not choose a single band. They chose, you know, me from one band, Paul Merkovich, our musical director, from another, and, you know, so on like that. A couple of the guys in the band did audition together, though. I think that Paul and Sasha auditioned together. And then I also, Paul and Sasha and Hoffa, actually, I think, all auditioned together. And then Sasha and Jim actually auditioned in another band together, and then I auditioned in a band with a guy named Derek.
What are some of the challenges that you face when recording in the studio in regards to your drum kit?
Playing drums, first and foremost, when you're recording, you know, you've got to have an instrument that sounds record-worthy or that sounds recordable. And what that means is, even beyond the tuning of the drums and making sure that they're, you know, in the right range for the size of the drum and so on, or the snare, and making sure if it's a hip-hop song, maybe a smaller snare cranked up. If it's a rock song, a bigger snare, maybe cranked down. Even beyond that, there are little things that can be headaches, like a squeaky bass drum pedal or a hi-hat stand that makes noise, or a lug that rattles on a drum when you hit it. So those are some of the things that you've got to sort of be prepared for when going to do gigs. And there are companies that actually specialize specifically in making studio-ready drum sets. One in particular called Drum Doctors, which is the company here in town. And there's another called Drum Paradise, and they specifically have studio-ready drum kits for that exact reason. And then, when you record, there are things that you have to deal with in terms of where your, you know, how you position your drum kit. When you play live, you know, there may be an inch and a half of clearance between your hi-hat and your snare drum. But when you record in the studio, they've got to be able to get a microphone in there. So sometimes you've got to adjust your, you know, your drum set positioning in order to accommodate for the fact that there will be mics. And that's, you know, that's sometimes a little bit of an adjustment. At this point, I do a lot of recording in my own studio, and I've kind of gotten very accustomed to where things are. And so generally, my setup these days allows for a certain amount of space and a certain amount of mic placement, you know. And that goes for when you're playing, you know, clubs as well. You know, people got to be able to get mics around your kit, things like that. So,
you play in so many different situations. I was wondering, how important is it not only to have the skill, but I think more importantly, a great set of ears?
Yeah, well, that's very important. You know, that's very important. One of the things that I stress, a lot of people send me emails and they say, what would be, you know, the most important bit of advice that you could give to an up-and-coming drummer? And I always say, listen to as much music as you possibly can and play as much music in as many different contexts as you possibly can. Basically because that's what, you know, that's what I did, you know, and that's what I found very helpful. So in terms of having your ears, you know, and using your ears, that is crucial. But then what goes hand in hand with that is having the facility on the kit to react to what you're hearing. So in other words, you're playing a jazz tune, you hear the piano player soloing, and he implies a samba feel. He implies a songo, let's say, or some other, you know, or he implies a 3-against-2 polyrhythm. As the drummer, and you want to be able to react to that, you need to know how to play a samba. You need to know how to play a songo. You need to know how to superimpose 3-against-2. So, you know, your ears are crucial, but also the ability to sort of expand your horizons as far as you can in terms of what you're able to do on the kit is also important, you know, and that was kind of my thrust. When I was in school, and to this day, I was never, like, the chops guy. I definitely was never, like, it's funny, they had this competition every year, you know, fastest hands, world's fastest hands, you know. I was never that guy, you know. I Dennis Chambers, he's that guy, man. He has so much facility, it's unreal, you know. Yeah. But I was always the guy who wanted to be sort of versatile. You know, I wanted to be the guy that you could call to do any gig and could do it. And so, as a result, when I went to Berkeley, I studied Latin drumming with Ed Uribe. I studied straight-ahead jazz drumming with Ron Savage and with John Ramsey, who was there at the time. I studied outside of school, you know, polyrhythmic development with Gary Chafee, so that, you know, if the phone rings and it's Natalie Cole, as you know, who I played with for a couple of years, it's like I'm prepared to go on that gig and be able to re-gig band jazz charts and sling a big band. And if the phone rings and it's, you know, a techno dance artist like BT, I'm able to sort of adapt to that setting and know what it takes to make that gig work. And I don't approach, obviously, those two gigs, you would not approach the same way at all.
There's something that really caught my ear when I was watching one of the episodes of Rockstar Supernova. Actually, it put a smile on my face. You were right in the middle of playing Razorblade by the tune by Blue October, but Zyra Alvarez was doing it, and you used the twin pedals. Man, the effect was so great. I don't know if you noticed that or not.
Yeah, I don't know if I noticed it. I'm sure our musical director did, because sometimes when I get a little double pedal happy, I draw a raised eyebrow from Paul.
Boy, did that ever carry the tune though? Man, that just nailed it.
Wow, well, thank you so much, man. Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah,
I definitely try to push what I can get away with sometimes.
What was it like?
And that song in particular, I mean, that song in particular is very much a, it's an edgy, sort of angry,
in your face
sort of powerful song, you know? And so it's okay, I think, to be a little on edge when you're playing some of those kinds of songs.
Incredible tune. I wanted to ask you what it was like working with Natalie Cole.
Natalie was a great, great, great learning experience. Natalie was inspiring in many ways because during that time period, it really pushed me to expand the limits of my jazz playing. You know, I mean, I hadn't done, outside of doing the occasional sort of pickup jazz gigs here in L.A., I hadn't really done a real quote-unquote jazz gig maybe since, you know, one of my earlier gigs, Chico Freeman. So to be thrust into that situation where not only am I playing jazz, but I'm also playing, you know, I'm reading big band charts, because Natalie had in her book at the time, you know, 200 plus charts. And on any given night, it was not, you know, it wasn't a pop gig where you play the same 14 song set every single night. It was, you know, on any given night, she could pull any 18 songs to do from her book of, you know, over 200. So it required a pretty extensive amount of reading, and it required me getting my brush technique together, and it required me getting my jazz technique together, really, you know. And on that gig, I was kind of the pipsqueak, because I was flanked. I was surrounded by really amazing, amazing jazz musicians.
Mm.
Terry Trotter, for example, on piano.
Oh, wow.
I mean, Terry is, you know, incredible, terrifying jazz pianist.
Yeah.
So that gig was a wonderful, quick education.
What do you think was Elvin Jones' biggest contribution to music?
I would say, I can't say necessarily to music, but I can definitely say to me his biggest contribution was sort of the inspiration that his power brought. You know, I mean, seeing how powerfully he, you know, played the kit, it was amazing. I mean, he played with sort of an unbridled passion, if you will, that I found very inspiring, you know, and that I find inspiring to this day.
Aside from Berklee, do you have any other formal training?
Well, I studied with Grant, as you know, prior to attending Berklee. Interestingly, I would be remiss if I didn't include, at age 8 or 7 maybe even, I began taking piano lessons. And basically what happened was I started playing drums sort of self-taught and putting together drum sets and playing toy drum sets when I was 4. My parents purchased for me a real drum set when I was 5. And so from that point on, I was playing drum set. At 7, my mother got me piano lessons. So I wasn't taking drum lessons. I was taking piano lessons at the time, but I was still playing drums, obviously. And I continued piano lessons through a variety of private instructors. At one point, I attended Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore. And when I was in high school, and I wanted to begin taking lessons with Grant, my mom said, because at the time I didn't want to take piano lessons anymore, and my mom said, well, look, if you continue to take piano lessons, I will get you drum lessons additionally. So that's when I began with Grant. So I studied piano formally from age 7 or 8 up to the end of high school. And then I studied formally drum set lessons from high school through graduating Berklee.
Aside from the drums, are there any other instruments that you play or maybe you would like to play? I know you just mentioned the piano, but I was wondering if there's any other instruments.
Well, any of my house bandmates from the show will definitely tell you that whenever we're not practicing a song, I immediately run to Sasha's bass and grab it, and I try to play bass.
Oh.
But I'm not by any stretch a bass player, but I definitely love playing bass. And continuing on that, Rafael, our lead guitarist, immediately, as soon as I get up from the drum set, runs to the drum set. So we often try to think of, you know, songs that we can play as a band with me playing bass and Hoffa playing guitar, and, or rather Hoffa playing drums and Sasha playing guitar. It it doesn't sound really good, but we have a lot of fun doing it.
I bet. Wow. What are you listening to these days, Nate?
Well, right before you called, I was actually listening to Chick Corea, Eye of the Beholder. I mean, for some reason, as I mentioned to you earlier in the conversation, you know, there's that category of sort of Sunday morning cooking breakfast music. And so when I'm around the house and I'm doing work around the house, I tend towards, you know, the 7-year-old Sunday morning cooking breakfast music, which is, as I said, Chick and Spyro Gyra and things of that nature. So that's what I was listening to just now.
I'd like to feature something from Kind of Blue, but first off, I'd like to get your comments regarding this classic recording.
Well, I mean, I think it's a standout, you know, it's one of the all-time great, not jazz recordings, one of the all-time great recordings, period, ever. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I mean, it has an appeal that transcends jazz in the sense that, you know, jazz tends to require a little bit of a, you know, it can be a little bit of an acquired taste or a little bit of a sort of a, you know, it operates on a level where you, how can I put this? It requires a really sort of deep musical understanding many times. Whereas Kind of Blue is a record that if you have that, you know, sort of deeper sort of musical understanding, it's amazing. But then even if you don't, and even if you just listen to the amazing melodies and just sort of the lyricism of it, or how, you know, how hard it swings when it swings, you know, it's still meaningful and sort of spiritual, if you will, to anyone, I think.
What's your favorite track off the album?
You know, probably So What.
I love the beginning. I love, you know, it's Paul's bass at the beginning there. And
yeah, it's just beautiful. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
Beautiful.
Do you have any instructional books or videos out at the moment?
You know, at the moment I don't, but I have been asked about that several times, so perhaps it's something that I should look into. But yeah, right now I don't. It's one of those things that I was often asked about during the season. And during the course of the season, you know, it's everything that I can do to sort of keep up with our workload and keep pace with what we've got to do for that. But once the season ends, which is, you know, in another few days, basically the finale will air on Wednesday. Once the season ends, hopefully I will have the time and the opportunity to sort of put some of those things together.
Do you do a lot of practicing?
When I was in college, my instructors told me, practice now, because when you get out of this place, you will never have a chance to practice. And at the time, you know, because they basically said, you'll be so busy playing and you'll be so busy living life that you won't be able to make time to practice. And at the time, I just thought to myself, yeah, right, I'll be busy playing. Gosh, I'll be lucky if I get a gig. Who knows, you know?
Yeah.
Well, they proved to be absolutely correct, because when you are playing, you know, when you're playing full time, it is very challenging to make time to practice.
Yeah.
How I practice now. Here's how I practice now. My son has a drum set in his room, and I took it upon myself to put another small drum set in his room.
Wow.
So every day I play a little bit with my son, and we play drums. And if it's for 5 minutes or 55 minutes, I manage to sit down every day and do a little something. But that's more playing. We made a deal because my son wanted a drum set. And I said to him, okay, I'll put a drum set in your room, but I want you to play every day. I said, if you play for 30 seconds, that's okay. But I said, I want you to play it every single day. I want you to sit down for at least 30 seconds and just do a little something. And so he does that. And so I do that, because I have a drum set in this room now, too.
Wow.
My wife loves it, as you might imagine.
Oh, I bet. One thing I want to ask you, one of the things I do when I do get down here and start playing the drums is I turn all the lights out. So it's just pitch black, and I play in the dark, because that way I get a sense of where I am with the in relation to the symbols and the toms and all that kind of stuff. I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but...
No, I used to do that when I was in college.
Oh, did you?
I mean, I went through my heaviest period of practicing when I was at Berkeley. My first 2 years at Berkeley, I mean, that was definitely my, 8 hours a day practicing period.
Hmm.
I definitely did that. And I would do stuff. I would do other things. Like now, here's on the subject of practicing, here's one of the things that I'm doing now to sort of passively practice. I've started trying to strengthen my left side so that, things are sort of more even when I do fills and sort of just sort of strengthen my independence and all that.
Mm.
So what I've started doing now is I will play the drum kit sort of completely backwards, which is not, I didn't invent that, obviously. Many, many, many people do it. But I'll put my left foot on the slave pedal of the twin pedal, and I'll play with my right hand on the snare, and I'll actually mount a ride cymbal or something that I can ride on, if it's a big China maybe, or something that I can ride on my left side. And I will, clamp down the closed hi-hats, or I'll clamp down the hi-hats so that they're, medium closed or closed. And I'll play, rehearsals now backwards, which is something that I've been doing for a little while now, the last 4 weeks or so, and I'm really enjoying that. So that's sort of my way of sneaking in practicing without actually, having to make extra time to do it.
That's a good idea, because I'm weak on my right side. I'm left-handed. And I've always had a problem trying to get the two balanced, because Buddy Rich gave some incredible advice years ago. He said you should always be able to play what you can with your left hand with your right hand.
Sure.
But I was just going to say that I guess that's a struggle for a lot of drummers, no? Trying to get that?
Oh, certainly. I mean, it's a struggle for both. It's interesting. I mean, it only makes sense. I was just discussing this with someone the other day. It only makes sense because, if you play, say, mainstream contemporary music, your right hand is the one that's doing, for example, 16th notes on the hi-hat. Or your right hand is the one that's going spang, spang, a lang, spang, a lang, spang, a lang, spang, a lang, spang, a lang. Or is playing, ting, ta ta ting, ta ting, ting, ta ta ting, ta ting, ta ta ting, ta ting, ting, ta ta ting, right? Whereas your left hand is the one that's going bat, 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 bat. So what happens is, at least what I have found personally, is my right hand is, far faster and has far more sort of dexterity, if you will, than my left, but it's not nearly as powerful. My left hand is much stronger than my right hand. So, what I'm saying? So if you could just measure, sound pressure level coming off a snare drum when I hit it with my left versus when I hit it with my right, my left hand blows my right hand away. But my left hand, I don't have the fingers and the control that I have in my right hand. So that is definitely what I'm attempting to balance by sort of playing left-handed, much to the chagrin of my bandmates.
who go,
what the heck are you doing?
Yeah, really. What would be the most important advice you could give, not only an up-and-coming drummer, because I know you mentioned something earlier on, but any musician for that matter?
Not to be redundant, but I would have to say probably the same thing that I would say to any drummer, which is to listen to as much music as you possibly can and to play as much as you possibly can in as many, varied settings as you possibly can.
Dexter, right. I think it was Dexter Gordon that was in a bus station one time, and he was listening to the sound of the wheel or something like that, and he was conceptualizing ideas for a song,
Right.
Like, it doesn't even have to be music. It's the birds, everything, It's
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, on that similar subject, and I think the movie was The Cotton Club with Gregory Hines.
Yes.
I don't remember exactly, but I think it was Cotton Club with Gregory Hines, and there's a whole bit on that when he's talking about inspiration for dancing. And there's a whole thing where I could be wrong about the movie, but I feel like there's like a whole thing where he was in the street and there was a jackhammer, and the rhythm of the jackhammer he began to apply to this particular tap routine that he was doing. And then, you know, a taxi cab went by and hit a pothole, and then that worked its way into the thing. And they, you know, they Hollywooded it out, you know, but the concept is still just as valid. I mean, it's a very valid concept.
I want your comments on the following five drummers. Okay, the first one is Clayton Cameron.
Amazing. Brush technique out, you know, like just outer space. Incredible. Super musical. What more can I say?
Will Calhoun.
Amazing technique. Amazingly powerful. Good job for being able to be in a successful black rock band, because there are not enough of them out there.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, so last year on the show, there was a contestant named Ty. And when Ty was no longer on the show, in his parting, he said some things that were at the time somewhat controversial.
Mm-hmm.
And what he said were words to the effect of, you know, it's unfortunate that, I'm paraphrasing, but what I gathered from it was, it's unfortunate that, you know, minorities, particularly black folk, are not as sort of supported and, well, support is the best word that I can use, in the rock, you know, idiom.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a lot of people ask me sometimes, they say, you know, what do you think about that, Nate? Didn't you think that was weird that Ty said that? Didn't you think that was weird that he said that, you know, he called the industry racist or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
And my response is always this. How many Living Colors are there?
Hmm.
There's one. Do you think that Living Color is the only incredible black rock band on the face of the planet? Do you think they're the only ones? No. In New York City, right now, at this very moment, there are probably 27 bands that sound like that that are playing their butts off. But because, you know, certain precepts that people have about music and what people should look like, and, you know, depending on what the music sounds like, you know, you may never hear of them, you know?
Look at Lenny Kravitz. You know, there's an amazing drummer. I love his drummer. It's Cindy Blackman. Cindy Blackman, yeah. I get her mixed up with another group. I don't know. I mix her up with this other drummer, but, yeah, Cindy's an incredible drummer. And there's a good example of a band that's, you know, totally valid.
Right. Totally. And Lenny Kravitz, too. Lenny Kravitz is another. He has managed to sort of transcend, you know, all of that. He's managed to transcend cultures. And I don't mean to imply that you know, music is outwardly at all, you know, biased or anything like that. Just to say that, you know, there are a lot of great bands out there that sort of struggle against that. There's another incredible band called 24/7 Spies, which is one of my all-time favorite bands, and they've been doing it since before Living Color. And, you know, but unfortunately, not a lot of people have ever heard of them.
Hmm. Another drummer I'm sure you've heard of, and he's one of my favorites and so underrated, is Alan Dawson.
Oh, man, yeah, Alan. Well, you know, Alan was teaching at Berkeley, I think about two semesters before I went there. Maybe a few more than that, but he was teaching at his home at the time, and unfortunately, I never managed to make it to a lesson with him. His health, unfortunately, again at that time, started to sort of decline, and he was not teaching English, and I sadly did not get to take a lesson with him.
What about Joe Morello?
Yeah, he came and did a clinic at our school, but Take Five was one of the, that was my first exposure to hearing odd time signatures in music. And at the time, it was so sort of well done and so musical that I didn't even notice that it was in an odd time. And it was not until much later on that I even realized that Take Five is, in fact, in five.
But don't you find that the drum solo in Take Five is a perfect example of how to pace yourself as a drummer?
Oh, absolutely. You know, well, when I say musical, that's partly what I mean. You know, I mean in the sense that you are not being constantly bombarded with a flurry of notes and chops and so on. I mean, the fact that you can hear in your head and sing the drum solo speaks to how sort of, you know, musical it is. I mean, I want to say how melodic it is, but by the strictest of definitions of melody, it's not exactly melodic per se, but it definitely has that character in the sense that it is singable. You know, you can hear it in your head.
Max Roach always said that a drum solo should always tell a story.
Wow, yeah, absolutely.
That's one thing I learned from him early on, and that made a lot of sense. And the other one was Art Blakey made, I think, one of the most brilliant comments ever. He said, when you make a mistake, make sure it's big and loud so everybody can hear it. I just love that. What a
That's
guy.
That's great.
What a
That's
guy.
Kind of like Miles always said, if you play a wrong note, play it again.
Yeah. Well, you know, now you've got me going here, because I think Miles Davis, when he was with his band with Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter,
yep.
I think one night Dave Holland, I think, was the bass player, and I think it was Miles Davis or Herbie Hancock played the quote-unquote wrong chord, and Miles just took it in that direction, and the whole band
right.
followed, and they said, that was incredible.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
And when
exactly.
you start thinking like that, beautiful things happen.
Absolutely.
You mentioned a drummer earlier on, Dennis Chambers. What do you think of that stickmaster?
Dennis, you know, when I was in college, I wanted to be Dennis. I mean, he was amazing. You know, and I kind of, you know, was from Baltimore, so I would see Dennis playing around town. And in fact, my father at the time, when I was in high school, and it was looking more and more every day, I was going to try to, you know, be a professional at this crazy music thing. My father, like any father, wanted to prepare me for what I might have in store, you know. Mm. And so partly his idea of preparing me was to sort of try to let me know what I'm up against. So we lived in Columbia, Maryland at the time, and an artist playing at the lakefront, which is like a little area by where I lived. My father had passed it kind of on his way home and heard this drummer. So he raced home and said, we've got to go back to the lakefront. You've got to hear this drummer. You know, check it out. We go back, and basically what my father is attempting to illustrate is, here's this incredible drummer playing, and he's playing this goofy little jazz gig by the lakefront. So this is what you're competing with. You know, son, check this out. This guy's amazing, and he's playing a gig, this little jazz gig, for 50 people here. The drummer was Dennis Chambers.
Wow.
He was playing with Carl Filipiak, who is a longtime friend of his, and who he played on all his records with, and happens to be there in Baltimore. So I explained to my father, Dad, that's Dennis Chambers. You know, that's not, he's not, like, my father believed he was bringing me to hear a local Baltimore, you know,
wow.
drummer guy, a weekend warrior drummer guy,
yeah.
you know, and it was actually Dennis. So that's my first, you know, so I then took my dad home and, you know, rifled through my stacks of modern drummers and said, see that ad? That's Dennis. See that article? That's Dennis. See that cover story? That's Dennis. That's the guy you just want me to see. So that's the first story. Second one. So I'm at school. I'm at Berklee College of Music. And I'm basically, you know, at my wit's end because I just want to get out of school. I'm frustrated with it. I just want to be playing all the time. I don't want to be in college anymore. And I want to leave. And I want to basically, you know, move to New York and play or move to L.A. or whatever. So this is shortly after having seen Dennis Chambers, who came to the school for, like, a clinic or something. So I write Dennis a letter. Basically, the letter just said, I love your playing. I've always considered you an inspiration. I'm from Baltimore, too. I used to go hear you play with Carl Filipiak, blah, 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 blah. Currently, I'm a student at Berklee College of Music, but I'm probably going to have to leave soon because, you know, and at the time, I was having some financial issues being able to afford to stay in school.
Mm.
I said, I'm probably going to have to leave soon, and, you know, da, 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 da. So, cut to, a week later, my phone rings. My roommate answers the phone. It's like 6 in the morning or something, 7 in the morning. It's really early in the morning. Phone rings. Knock on my door. Nate, telephone. I'm like, tell him to go away. He's like, okay. So, no, I go, who is it? He goes, you know, okay, who is it? And my roommate says, Dennis Chambers. I go, yeah. Right. So, you know, I didn't say, yeah, right. I said, you know,
yeah.
whatever, you know. So he goes, no, Nate, it's Dennis Chambers on the phone. So I go, okay, whatever. So I answer the phone, and I'm like, you know, who is this going to be? Hello? Hello, Nathaniel. This is Dennis Chambers. Listen, I just got your letter. And da-da-da-da-da-da. And so I fall out of the bed. It's Dennis Chambers calling me, right? I freak out.
Oh,
we have a long conversation that morning, and a lot of what that conversation has to do with is Dennis Chambers basically saying, listen, you've been at that school for, you know, 2.5 years. You're a year or so away from graduating. It would be a crime if you didn't stay there and get the piece of paper. So my father, I owe, because he is an educator, I owe him with my completing Berkeley and my attending Berkeley. And in great part, I owe Dennis Chambers for my having graduated Berkeley. Yeah, Dennis Chambers calling me at 7 a.m. And it's interesting. It's unfortunate. I guess it's just because he lives on the East Coast and I live on the West Coast that I never see him. So I've never been able to sort of see him and recount that story. I suppose I could write him another letter, couldn't I?
Yeah,
maybe
yeah.
I should do that.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, it's unfortunate that I've not gotten to sort of recount that story to him yet. But this is sort of inspiring me. Maybe I'll find him online and send him an email.
Actually, I want to ask
let
you.
Let him know how positive an effect that was on me.
Yeah. What inspires you?
I find inspiration in a variety of things. And it's interesting now because lately, in terms of music, I not only play, but I also have gotten into sort of engineering more and songwriting more. So these days, you know, I'm inspired by lots of different things from, you know, I'm inspired by different things to do different things. So, for example, the other day I was at a session, and being at that session, I was playing drums at the session, and that sort of inspired me to want to go home and work on a particular mix that I was working on for another friend's, you know, song. So yeah, I'm inspired by different things.
Do you ever listen to older recordings to maybe learn a new drumming technique that you can incorporate into your playing?
I don't. Now, here's the thing. Because it's so rare that I'm able to practice, the things that work themselves into my playing come from just listening. So I don't consciously work them in, but things manifest themselves. Things kind of, you know, find their way.
Like osmosis,
into,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it may not be the exact same thing, but it may be something that was inspired by something that I heard. And partly because I didn't sit and shed the exact same thing, it kind of takes on a different character, which is sort of my thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As opposed to it sounding like, oh, that's that lick that you copped off of that one particular record.
What do you have on the go for the next few months?
Well, Rockstar is ending this upcoming week, and the house band will actually be touring, backing up Paul Stanley on his solo tour for October and November. And then we have the month of December off when we're going to be working on sort of a house band recording project, which remains to be seen exactly what shape that's going to take yet.
Mm.
And in January, we'll be on the road opening for Supernova, January through, I think, February and maybe even into March.
That's going to, now, do you know if that's a world tour or is that just of North America or the States?
The dates that I have thus far are just North America.
North America. Thank you so much for dropping by today, Nate. It's been a real pleasure.
No sweat. The pleasure has been mine, and happy to do it.